and welcome to an emergency episode of Radio Warner. The date today is September 11th, 2025, 9/11. And this is going to be episode 548. I am the co-host, the wounded and recovering co-host, Mark Ames in Western New York. You are listening to Radio Warner. Subscribe, please, and support the show. Subscribe at patreon.com/Radio Warnerd. And of course, I'm on the line with the Warner, John Dolan, aka Gary Brecher, back in the south of Italy. How you doing, John?
I'm good. We're back in Brindisi after celebrating a wedding in the far north of Italy. And I just want to say, you wouldn't think to look at a map that it would be so complex to get from the far south of Italy to the far north of Italy, like, you know, in the shadow of Mont Blanc. But it is. It's a very, very long trip. Yeah. And damn near killed me. But we're almost back now, just one more leg.
So damn near killed the U.S. Army in 1943.
Yeah.
Trying to move up there. So
Yeah, of course, our opposition was lighter. But, you know, they got to me anyway. But how's your arm?
It's so I still have this fucking sling with this giant cushion. So I'm in week three now of barely sleeping because you have to keep it on at all times. But it's getting better. You have to do these. Well, it gets stiff, of course, because you can't move it. And
right.
It was all cut up in there, and so then you do these sort of PT exercises that are all about trying to move it a bit, and it feels kind of like somebody jammed a pair of like wire cutter pliers in there and is squeezing and twisting it each time you try to move it another couple degrees. But it hasn't been as bad. It's a long process, but it hasn't been as painful as I was kind of worried about or told. At least for me, it hasn't been. I don't know. Or so far. It could still happen, I guess. But
it doesn't usually happen in the later stages. It's supposed to get better.
Yeah, exactly. So this comes off next week. It's just like you can barely type. You can't drive a car. You can't really do anything.
Oh, you can't drive?
No. Not allowed to with a sling on. And then next week it comes off. And at that point, I think pretty soon I'm going to actually start moving the arm around. It's going to be one of those skinny, atrophied arms. You know how that happens.
Oh, yeah.
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 But it's like, it feels to me, I've had three knee surgeries, two ACLs when I was younger. And somehow this just feels a lot slower than the knee, like less painful, but slower.
Right.
The knee was more painful, I think. I don't know.
Yeah, well, the knee, I suppose, is a load-bearing joint.
Yeah,
whereas
exactly.
The shoulders just occasionally go to work.
Yeah, and it's just this complicated thing that just takes longer, I think, to heal to the point where you can move the damn thing, right. Excuse my French. All right, so we got together today. John just got back down to southern Italy. You're in the heel again, right? Is Brindisi in the heel?
Yeah, in the heel.
Okay.
We were on a Frecciarossa, the high-speed train, which, thank God, is a lot easier to take than most trains. So, we've gone most of the length of the peninsula today, and I'm in the far south now.
Does it go fast?
You know, this news is too exciting to skip.
Yeah. So John, before getting home, we, you know, got in touch with each other and he said, yeah, let's do something on this because as everybody I'm sure knows, Charlie Kirk, major Trump, influencer, vote organizer, MAGA youth activist, probably the biggest, most famous voice in that world, certainly for under 40s, was assassinated yesterday at Utah Valley college campus in Orin, Utah.
Yeah, they call it UVU, I guess. So it's Utah Valley University.
Okay, yeah. That video went around everywhere. I'm sure you've seen it too. I saw it, but we
had only a small screen. I couldn't really see very much. And let me be honest here. If you are looking at a video of someone getting killed, you want to see them getting killed. That's just how it works. And I couldn't see much.
So you can see, and if you get a bigger screen or something, you can see him. Because it's filmed from a few angles, because there are all these people there, mostly fans, probably a few non-fans. But everybody films everything today when they attend something.
Right.
And you see the bullet hit his neck, and he snaps back in the chair and then slumps forward and starts falling. But immediately, blood goes pouring out, like in the most... kind of in the goriest movie versions of that, you know, that's exactly what it was like. They clearly got a vein or an artery, and it was just pouring out like an oil well.
I think they said it hit the carotid artery.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, the whole thing kind of, I don't know. The whole thing sort of reminds me a little bit, not to compare the two at all, of the MLK assassination, because he was hit in the throat as well. One shot, sort of at the bottom of the jaw, and that did him. And then there was a rifle, abandoned rifle, and then James Earl Ray, the suspect, you know, got away for a while, and there was a lot of weirdness with that. Somehow he's able to get all kinds of different passports, and he was eventually caught. Right now where we're at, they're saying that the gun was a bolt-action Mauser 30-06 rifle. Apparently,
isn't that what Oswald used?
Well, Oswald's, though, they initially said it was a Mauser, and then they said it was a Carcano. It's an Italian bolt-action rifle that friend of the show, Anibale, when we had him on talking about. So I think the subject of that Carcano came up because it's kind of notoriously poor quality. And and he said that, you know, that's one reason why Italians think something funny went on there, because it just seemed kind of implausible.
Right. Well, I mean, there's one thing that really, well, there are a lot of things that strike you about this one. One is the trend of sort of retro assassinations with long range sniping. Mm-hmm. I mean, That's twice now.
Yep.
First, the guy at the Trump rally with the very, very odd nicking the ear and then getting blown to bits. And now this. There was a long time, like most of our adult lives, where everyone seemed to think a short-barreled pistol was all you needed, or even in the Reagan case, a 22, for God's sake. after all, Oswald, the most successful and in our era the original, used a rifle with a scope and at long range, and that's always seemed like, looking at it very objectively in what Nietzsche would call a non-normative sense, that's always seemed like an opportunity that was just going begging.
Yeah. Drones, I would think, are the next opportunity. I'm surprised they still haven't been used. But yeah, long range, it's when I was younger and there were a lot of political assassinations and attempted assassinations. Aside from Oswald, all of them were pistols. Oh, no, I'm sorry. And MLK, of course, also was a rifle. That's right. True. But RFK, George Wallace, the two attempts on Ford, the attempt on Reagan in 76 or 75.
The ex-Manson girl firing from the crowd.
Yep. And then, you know, Lenin. And then it just stopped. And, you know, this is something we've been talking about assassinations now. Well, definitely since last summer with the attempted hit on Trump. And, you know, we're sort of puzzling over the strangeness that there were so many assassinations in this period in my kind of formative years. And then they just basically stopped. Killing didn't stop. Mm. Killing went just in a different direction. You know, rage murders and workplace massacres and school shootings. But for whatever reason, they weren't going after political figures. And, you know, my sense then from having like researched and written about at least, you know, school and workplace shootings is that, I mean, this is an imprecise or unscientific kind of explanation, but I think it's kind of true. Like, if they're not happening, they're not going to happen. And if they start happening, people who are going to kill might start thinking in whatever state of mind they're in, or whether it's for political reasons or for mental health reasons or anger, whatever it is. But when they see the reaction, they might start thinking that kind of killing is, I'm drawn to that kind of killing, a political killing. That's going to get me whatever I need from this, you know? And so I feel like that trend has been launched and people have seen the reaction to, you know, the reaction to the Trump shooting last summer and the story, and then the reaction to Luigi Mangione's shooting of the United Healthcare CEO, some others. And I feel like we're going to see more of that.
Yeah, it's odd though, because I mean, I've been looking in the few hours I've had to think about this over the trend in assassinations. Kirk was just a shill, you know? I mean, he was just what is the non-loaded term for what he did?
Influencer, I think, yeah.
An influencer, right.
Yeah.
It's sort of like the old joke about the dumb blonde who goes to Hollywood and sleeps with the scriptwriter. It's like influencers are a dime a dozen. I mean, they're kind of a sleazy appendage of the publicity organ, and they can be replaced very easily. I mean, when someone was a couple of inches away from killing Trump, that was something that almost happened and would be very big if it did happen. But without needless disrespect, stressing needless, to the deceased. What does killing Charlie Kirk actually do?
Well, I can tell you it definitely riles up the right. And if I were COINTELPRO, I'd be doing what a lot of left-wing liberal online accounts are doing. They're more of the kind of anonymous ones, which is, I mean, there is some of the most based, as they would say, like mockery going on of the assassination. Like there's a lot of talent going in. Some are really good.
Absolutely.
A lot of talent going into it. And but when I see that, you know, I just see that all as a part and parcel of the left wing's powerlessness, you know? I mean, that's what you do when you're powerless.
A tank is rolling over you, but you have a good comeback line.
Yeah. And it's definitely serving to just really rile up the right. Like there, I would be very surprised if there isn't more, you know, there was that guy in Minnesota who murdered some state Democrat lawmakers. That was a few months back. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if this gets some of that going. Like, if I were, I don't know, man, if I were head of security for like the two people highest up on their list, which would be Zoran Mamdani and AOC, I would make sure their security detail is really strong for like the next year at least. But otherwise, yeah, I it's weird watching this. I mean, let's say a left winger did this, or let's say as they're trying to push out now, it was somebody, in transgender or involved in transgender rights, because Charlie Kirk has been, you know, going after those people a lot. What would they achieve? What would they achieve? I don't know what it would achieve going after an influencer like that, except it would feel good for them. But yeah.
Well, what you're doing is hitting one in a crowd of desperately ambitious people who have no scruples at all. And there's just never any shortage of those mm-hmm. people. And I'm sure many of them are actually, you know, chuckling in their beers or whatever at the thought that one more rival has been eliminated. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a very crowded field. I started yes. looking into it, and
oh, yeah.
the influencer field is just jammed.
Yep.
And the fact that many of them are young, I would think, has kind of lost its gloss already. Like, there's a lot of them. There have always been, frankly, yeah. a lot of young right-wing males. And most of them having, you know, kind of sort of been one, although a much scruffier version. Most of them have problems.
Yeah.
And so the ones who are more presentable, the few who, you know, wash daily and change their clothes, they have a tremendous career opportunity compared to any more honest field, because there are so many people in their grandfather's and grandmother's generation who are so delighted that clean-cut young people still exist that they'll just throw money at them.
Yeah, I hear. But Charlie Kirk's a little bit different in that way. I mean, first of all, he is, aside from, I'd say he's actually a lot more influential than Laura Loomer. Loomer's influential specifically with Trump, I guess. But yeah. she's kind of, and she's probably a lot more hated even among righties than she is adored. I don't know.
Well, I was thinking of like Ben Shapiro. I mean, I'm
yes,
not.
Yes, but I'm he's, not, no. Charlie, I'm sorry. Charlie Kirk is different yeah. because he also runs a political machine. So he's different than Shapiro in the sense, I mean, you're right, that they're similar, but imagine if Shapiro also had a political machine, Turning Points USA, that mobilized voters and that raised money for Trump and MAGA, like tens of millions of dollars for campaigns. So he's kind of, he's more than that. He's also, you know, very deep within the kind of what would have been the moral majority world. It's like if Falwell was young and, you know, connected with Zoomer and millennial right wingers, and so he wasn't just an influencer or columnist.
I
or
see.
Whatever.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes
so
sense.
So that
right.
in that sense, he's big, and he's. But you're right. Like, there are a lot of influencers out there. I mean, Loomer, I think she deleted her big trashing, because I've been following a lot of these guys a lot more closely in the last few months than I used to. I kind of got over I held my nose, and Loomer yeah. was going after Charlie Kirk. And there's a lot of this internecine warfare because at the top, because everybody wants to be the top dog. And Loomer went after him because he started to break a little bit with Trump on like Israel, just a little bit. Or it hinted that he might break with Trump on Israel and a couple other things. And so Loomer just, you know, went on one of her Loomer savage attacks. It's literally just a couple of weeks ago that he's a betrayer, stabbed in the back. And Nick Fuentes, the guy who's the open anti-Semite, and he's the real deal in the MAGA right, because he's not afraid to say, like, the whole thing on the MAGA right influencer world is, we're not afraid to say the hard truths that everybody else yeah. is afraid to yeah. say, right? But then those hard truths are just grubby old Islamophobic cliches from the early Bush years, you know? So, yeah. so like Islamophobia is, that's where Charlie Kirk was pro-Israel Islamophobia. And that's kind of the Virgin MAGA, and the Chad MAGA is like Nick Fuentes, open anti-Semite. Yeah. And so Nick Fuentes and the Groypers have been mocking Charlie Kirk mercilessly for years. They go to his events and mock him because he's afraid to say anything bad about Jews in Israel. Yeah. And that's been his
whole... I have to admit, I knew nothing about this.
I
haven't been in the American scene for a long time. Okay.
You're missing a lot, John. It's wonderful over here. Yeah. but then after the killing, Loomer, of course, started attacking anybody who's been attacking Charlie Kirk while racing hers and calling for basically killing liberals and leftists and blaming it on leftists.
I thought you were going to say Loomer has had tons of respectful posts about how sad it is, and I just couldn't see her doing that.
No.
So the fact that she's turned to other enemies makes a lot more sense.
Or the same enemies. I mean, she's basically blaming campus protesters, Hamas, liberals, Democrats, et cetera. And what there is a lot on the right is a lot of this, because the memes on the left are really good, really sick, funny memes about, making fun of Charlie Kirk, because that's how he built up his following over the last 10 years, is riling up liberals and leftists by trashing everything that is dear to liberals and leftists. So, it's all part of the online game, and everyone's acting like they've never seen anything like this in their lives, and particularly righties are saying that, we've never been this way before. The rhetoric of violence is so much, it's so different from how it used to be. Like literally just 2 weeks ago, Matt Walsh, a big right-wing influencer, not quite the level of Charlie Kirk, he came out with this post that said that the mayor of Chicago needs to be arrested, tried for treason, and given a capital punishment for it. Like, this is how they talk all the time, all the time. And then on the other hand, whining about how leftists are provoking violence. What leftists and liberals do, not liberals, leftists really more, online leftists, some of them dummies, what they do is they celebrate in the safety of what you think is the safety of online. They celebrate murders. They celebrated when that guy from Las Vegas went into the NFL building and wound up just shooting like some woman who had some lower position in BlackRock or Blackstone or something. People are like, this is a political hit and we should celebrate it. They're just some idiots did that. It wasn't a big thing, but you can find, online, you can find every worst opinion you want and then ascribe an entire group to that. The single to the general. So I think getting back to it, I would be very surprised, and it's always bad to predict anything, but I would be very surprised if this was a well thought out assassination carried out by a leftist, because there just hasn't been anything like that since like the 70s when they used to set off bombs everywhere. Like, there just hasn't been anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, there are a few cases in a few insurgencies that I can think of. But basically, I mean, I would still – okay, it changes things that he was actually the controller of a powerful campaign fund. But I still say killing an influencer is not – smart, unless they're, I mean, and I was trying to think of anybody who has unusual charisma and unusual appeal. And granted, I'm obviously not up with the proverbial play, but I can't think of anybody irreplaceable on the right wing spectrum.
I agree. No, except at least for now, we're talking about online world, so it's like large subculture. But Nick Fuentes, I would say, is somebody, if he got whacked, for example, that would I don't really know, that movement would just totally disperse. There really isn't anybody like he is different, and he's constantly pushing MAGA kind of his way. He's in a big fight right now with I think I talked about before with Tucker Carlson.
Right.
Tucker's basically saying that he's probably a Fed because Feds would want to try to tarnish MAGA with anti-Semitism. And
that Fuentes is a Fed.
That Fuentes is a Fed, yeah. So Fuentes did this big takedown of Tucker about his CIA past, his CIA daddy, and all this stuff, you know. Right. But Fuentes is the only guy I've ever seen who really did start to normalize in a very effective, he's very good at what he does, in a very effective way, normalizing and making cool anti-Semitism as the real authentic MAGA thing, that if you're not authentic unless you go there, that, you know, Islamophobia is so passe. And so basically you're just serving the deep state, Israel, Zionist, blah, blah, blah.
Raises the question of where Marjorie Taylor Greene comes into this, because I don't think, as far as I know, she's been anti-Semitic, but she's definitely become anti-Israel.
Mm-hmm. She's
in
flirting
a public
with
way.
It. Yeah, she's like within what Israel accepts and the pro-Israel Zionist crowd accepts. She has turned anti-Israel. Yeah, I don't think her rhetoric has actually been very anti-Israel, if you compared to Nick Fuentes or something, but it's definitely questioning, and questioning is the questioning is anti-Semitism according to like the
right.
official
well,
ideology.
There's always been this very muted, necessarily muted grumble among American nationalists on the right wing that, but you know, much like the early scene in Miller's Crossing that I've mentioned before, mm-hmm. like what does backing Israel get us and mm-hmm. what does it cost us? And I don't know if that can be attributed to anti-Semitism at all, but it's always been a conclusion that if you're a serious American nationalist of the old national security type, has to occur to you.
Yes. It's out there. It's out there a lot more. And Charlie Kirk, so I, you know, as I've said, I've been trying to watch more of these guys. And Charlie Kirk has kind of seems to have started to make a turn too, because of where it's sort of like he's trying to make sure he's seen as relevant and still, like, his appeal is still that he's somewhat radical. Now, to the Nick Fuentes types, he's a total squishy sellout.
Well, yeah. See, maybe I've been fooled by photography, but that's what he looks like.
Yes, totally.
He sure looks like somebody who played a bit part in some kids' comedy long ago.
Yeah, that's very good. Yeah. Like some Nickelodeon live action, you know, series. So, yeah, but I would say this. I still think your point is totally valid. Like killing him, it is a high value target as influencers and political figures, not actually being politicians, go. It's high value, but I totally agree. He's replaceable. 100% is replaceable. And it's not the case with, you know, a president or probably a couple senators or probably, you know, some Supreme Court, whatever. There are other people who would actually have real world-changing effects if you took him out. But of course, he's also a softer target too, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Although, once again, as a throwback to the assassinations of many decades ago, that seems like quite a shot. I mean, it was 130 meters away. I don't claim to be a real rifle expert, but that's not bad.
It's what I've seen. Well, it's really hard to tell. There's a bunch of then macho gun, you know, I'm a gun expert and this is my opinion. And a lot of them are saying that's actually like with some practice, you would not have to be a marksman. You wouldn't even have to be a seasoned like hunter. But if you're a seasoned hunter, that would have been an absolutely easy shot. If you have done a bit of hunting, you're familiar with this gun and you've practiced. If you're lying down in your stomach and you've got this gun, which is, it's an older gun, the Mauser 30-06, but it's, very accurate, and you have a good scope on it, and it's a bolt action rather than a semi-automatic, and it's a bolt action, that it's not a hard shot. Now, if you've never really practiced and you're like one of these people who's averse to guns, but you're doing this because you hate Charlie Kirk, then they said, yeah, that would be pretty unusual. It'd be very unusual or lucky.
Right.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, we still have to wait to see who did it. And again, if we go by the previous shooters, it's going to be somebody with completely confused politics. You won't be able to pinpoint it. That's if we go by history, but you know, this again could be different.
Yeah, the number of assassins who keep changing their minds. When I looked into this anthology of assassinations, really was extraordinary. By the way, the book I'm talking about, and I really recommend it highly, is Encyclopedia of Assassinations. More than 400 infamous attacks that changed the course of history. That's another issue that we could raise today, but I don't think assassinating Charlie Kirk is likely to change the course of history. The question of whether assassinations change the course of history, myself, I say yes, they do. And the consensus, and a lot of people have been saying this very publicly, look, this won't do any good. It won't matter. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it might. Yeah. I mean, that is, assassinations might matter.
Yeah. I mean, just briefly from your list here, Yitzhak Rabin, Abraham Lincoln, we've talked about these, you know, Bobby Kennedy, who would have defeated Nixon, Alexander VI. Yeah, all of these were consequential. Not killing Trump, shooting him and not killing him had a big mobilizing effect. I think people underestimated it at the time. But I would say this, this could have an effect in a kind of, and forgive me for this analogy, but in a kind of a Kirov assassination way, where I think the evidence is that Stalin didn't order it, but he did take advantage. He did see an advantage to that hit in order to clamp down harder on his enemies that he was having factional fights with. And it's, I mean, if you're judged by the major voices on the right, whether in government or out of government, they all want to use this to really clamp down hard. And as far as I've been able to tell, on everybody who opposes them, you know, obviously starting with the campus protesters for Palestine, but really extending it to everybody that they hate. And this is the thing about the right. The right hates so well and has a—
So well and so broadly.
So deeply, And I think they are— I would expect that Trump, because Trump knew Charlie Kirk well, he was an important figure in that very personal world, that you know, in Trump world. And
I mean, once again, it's like I can see him in his sitcom self, like, golly, Mr. Trump, that's a great idea.
Yeah, Charlie, you got to grab her pussy. Well, Mr. Trump, golly, well, Jesus said something like that, and you know. Acts 12:11. I could see things getting rougher for the next 6 months, 6 to 12 months. And we don't have an opposition party at all to speak of.
They quit on us.
They quit.
I assume they think they're doing some sort of profound double reverse play. But basically, they just quit.
They decided
everything's going our way anyway.
Yes.
The people who are supposed to be our fans, we don't agree with at all, like the people protesting about Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll just let the Republicans take all the flack for it.
I think you're right. I think that's part of it. Part of it is they don't like politics, you know, doing, actually having to take political stances. But I think also a lot of it is a sullen, you didn't want us anyway, see how you like it without us. This is all your fault. You're going to come crying for us when this is all over.
Yeah.
I really think there's, because you see that online from them a lot, like, Congratulations. Well, that you got what you wanted.
Because they're all like 100 years old. I know. But, yeah. But, you know, in terms of what this will do, and just to underline my thesis that influencers are infinitely replaceable, the guy who really seemed interesting for a while there was Steven Crowder, who actually was a child star on TV in some show that I didn't ever see, and grew up to be a smirking right-wing provocateur, and wasn't particularly good at it, but was beloved for it by all kinds of guys who thought they'd probably be just as witty as he was, but they never had the guts to do it. And then there was this video of him whining and berating his wife, who, to be fair, probably did know that the camera was going and it was recording everything. But beyond that, he just doomed himself. He was whiny and just terribly weak, not what you would seem to want as a right-wing consumer. And as far as I know, he sort of vanished after that.
I'm not sure. I would have thought so too, but he was the first one pushing out the theory that was apparently leaked by some police force people that the shooter scrawled some pro-trans and Antifa slogans on the bullets, which is already also being reported in other outlets, like the New York Times, is not true. And, you know, I guess we won't know again until all this comes out. But I just saw, I was like, I haven't seen that Crowder name in a long time. And people were quoting Crowder saying, according to his information. So I don't know. You know, that's the thing about the right. If you're pushing their book, there's always a place for you. They don't really turn on you in the same way the left.
No, they're very forgiving as long as you chime in with something that's useful in the moment.
Yeah. So, but I think what he did do is he missed his chance to be Ben Shapiro level, sort of, you know, A-list. I think he probably knocked himself out of that. Let's talk about a couple other things real quickly, but I think before we wrap this up. Speaking of assassinations, Israel just a couple of days ago bombed Qatar, bombed a Hamas meeting. I think what people have sort of are agreeing on now, what they agree on that pretty much happened, is that they've been trying to, Witkoff has been trying to get even the worst ceasefire deal going to release the rest of the hostages. Israel, of course, doesn't want any deal. Then I think Israel wrote some kind of a deal essentially for Witkoff that said, okay, here's the plan. Hamas gives us all the hostages first. Then we promise to act good and to do it, you know, to do all the other things you say. But first you got to give every single person. And then Israel said, oh, shit, we accept our proposal. we just handed to Stephen. So now the ball's in Hamas's court. So then Trump started saying, it's up to you now, Hamas, whether you want to die or, you know, you have to discuss this. So the Hamas political leadership outside of Gaza gathered in a building in Qatar. And it turned out to be the same trick that Israel and I'm sure Trump or, you know, the U.S. pulled on the Iranians when they were negotiating, some kind of a nuclear deal and assassinated in the middle of discussing it. So Israel bombed Qatar, but amazingly it didn't work. They didn't kill any of the senior leadership, but they do appear to have really upset their Gulf friends that, we'll see how long that lasts. But they're starting to see Israel as a really dangerous, destabilizing force. Like, this is not something it's not a phase that they're getting over. that this is something permanent. And so
blood
I don't
simple.
Know. Yeah. So, and Trump is saying that he didn't, it's hard to believe this. Trump's saying he didn't know and that the U.S. wasn't informed in advance, which seems.
Right. He said something kind of lukewarm, but disapproving, like,
yeah,
I'm not too thrilled about it or something.
I, you know, it's hard for me to believe that because the U.S. has the largest base, military base in the whole Middle East is there. And it's an airfield. And of course, they're constantly on alert for any aerial attacks, drones, missiles, anything. Wouldn't the systems have been activated when the Israelis have had to tell? First of all, how'd the Israelis even travel that far without, I don't know, refueling? Yeah. I don't buy it. I think it was an inside job. And I feel like maybe Qatar was also informed maybe at the last minute, and that's how the Hamas leadership was able to escape it. Either that or the Israelis just, you know, they've been getting so lucky this time they didn't get lucky.
Yeah, well, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, the downside of doing an inside job with all your little corrupt allies in the region is that some of them might not be 100% corrupt, and they're going to make a call to their contacts in Hamas. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, people are talking about, you know, the Qatar's, I don't know, sovereignty. I mean, what is Qatar, man? It's an American airbase. It's a bunch of natural gas. It's 300,000 citizens and like 2 million slaves or something like that. You know, it's of course it doesn't have sovereignty.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, what can Qatar do? The U.S. has its base there. No one's going to come to Qatar's defense. Who's going to come to their defense? The Saudis, the Turkey's not going to come to their defense. Turkey's kind of their muscle because they share the Muslim Brotherhood sort of, you know, in common. Qatar's a big funder of Muslim Brotherhood, and Turkey is sort of the main power for the Muslim Brotherhood. But Turkey's not going to go to war against the U.S. and Israel for Qatar. It's just not going to happen. So Qatar has no choice. They're just going to have to take it. And I feel that's, I mean, that's the great thing when you're an empire and you have these corrupt dictatorships. Where are they going to turn to? They can't really go anywhere. They may try with China, but China is not, at least thus far, any kind of international power. They're a regional power.
No, but I think that's brilliant.
Yes, exactly. Like, exactly.
It's a very smart move. And they don't even have to make any moves. They just sort of drift into partnership with Russia. And that's a natural resource power and an industrial power that's much, much bigger than the German power that Russia used to be more or less in league with.
By the way, I don't know if anybody brought this up, but in 2004, Russia assassinated Yandarbayev. He was the president he was sort of like the Salafist president. There were almost like two governments in Chechnya during the war and from like 99 on. And Yandarbayev, he was like the senior figure in sort of the line that extended down to Shamil Basayev and Khattab and like that, this sort of Salafist jihadi wing. And FSB agents, the Duma passed the law to give kind of legal, internal legal gloss to it that allowed FSB to carry out assassinations again. And shortly afterwards, he was blown up in Qatar in downtown Doha, I think it was. And they caught the FSB guys. And then there was some kind of deal that they eventually brokered to release him.
I remember that. Yeah. I thought the name Yandarbayev sounded familiar. Yeah.
And, you know, Russia's carried on relations with them. They've had good and bad relations. Russia has particularly good relations with the UAE. It's a bit more complicated, I would say, with Qatar. Another assassination that happened in between the last episode and this one, Andriy Paruby. Just very briefly on this. This was a pretty big one. This is in Ukraine, in Lvov, in Western Ukraine. Andriy Paruby is a very big figure. He is a neo-Nazi. I don't know how else to describe him. I can post some photos of him from. He was the co-founder of the Social National Party of Ukraine. That's where the Azov Wolfsangel, that kind of Nazi-looking Wolfsangel symbol, it starts with. Starts with Paruby. He published a book in the 90s, his Mein Kampf. It's called like something like Zgliad Spravi, like View from the Right. Has all these passages like, you know, the white civilization is threatened by the Asiatic Muscali, Judeo-Muscali, Bolsheviks. It's just all this kind of shit that Ukraine is the last bastion of white civilization protecting Europe, etc. And eventually that party became, he then headed a paramilitary version of that party that that eventually evolved into both Azov and Right Sector. And then he sort of did an entryist thing and entered into more kind of mainstream Orange Revolution politics in Ukraine with more kind of, as they call it, liberal nationalist politics. And his partner stayed in the far right and changed the name, the Social National name, to the Svoboda Party, the Freedom Party. Paruby, in the Maidan Revolution, he headed the so-called Self-Defense Committee. Dmitry Yarosh, who was the head of Right Sector, he was the deputy. And, you know, we had Ivan Kachanovsky on the show during the Maidan violence. There's a lot of evidence that there was a lot of false flag shootings going on to incite violence, to make sure that there was no deal cut with Yanukovych. And, you know, Paruby is an actual Nazi. Like, he was filmed even with people carrying these long violin cases into the building where the shots were fired, into the building that he commanded and stuff. Yeah. Then he became the head of the National Security Council after the Maidan Revolution. And then he became the Speaker of the Parliament, the Rada, and headed Ukraine's efforts to join NATO. And he also led, kind of from the political side, the opposition to Zelensky taking power in 2019. Jewish, Russian-speaking. He was accusing him of being a Russian puppet and all this stuff. And then he's still an MP, but he became he definitely started to become irrelevant after the war started. You didn't hear much from Paruby. It was sort of like he'd already created so much of this Bandera world. He's a big fan of Bandera and, you know, that World War II collaborator. He's already, like, that he himself, he was kind of a somewhat spent force, it seems. So it was kind of odd that he was killed.
Well, there is that tradition where in the Night of the Long Knives or whatever the equivalent is, you know, you get rid of some of your original street fighting chums because they might be embarrassing to carry around on the larger global stage.
Yeah, but Paruby was like, he was also had made himself respectable, you know, and you could ignore his past, I guess, and actually in his present as well. He spoke fondly of Hitler in 2018 in the Rada speech in the parliament. But nevertheless, when he was killed, you know, I think it was the president of the European Commission, former U.S. ambassadors, a lot of big name Western politicians, you know, talked about him as my friend and this is terrible and we can't let this go. Russia obviously did it. It happens at the same time that Zelensky is facing his first real threats to his power with those protests that happened, with the UK really promoting the commander that he fired, Valery Zaluzhny. And, you know, as Strana.ua, this really good opposition website, Ukrainian website, said, if anybody knows how to organize a new color revolution, it was Paruby. They wound up arresting a guy. And it's a lot of people are very suspicious that it's real. It doesn't really add up. So he was killed walking the streets of Lviv. some guy on a scooter, like a delivery guy with a helmet, mask, and a backpack, you know, going on an electric scooter, which you might have with regular delivery people, went right up to him. It clearly cased him, went right up to him, pumped 7 bullets into Parubi. Mm-hmm. The next day, the SBU, former KGB, I think it was, arrested a guy named Mikhailos Selnikov. I don't know. It's like STS, Selnikov. Mm-hmm. And he's like in his 50s, you know, not wealthy at all. And it turns out that his son was killed in the Battle of Bakhmut. And he claims he killed Parubi. The whole thing doesn't make sense because the guy from the videos on the scooter did not look like somebody who was 50. He looked like sort of like the Charlie Kirk guy.
I saw
thin.
That video. Yeah. And yeah, he looked pretty spry.
Thin and spry. Yeah, exactly. But he's admitting to it. And he said he did it because his son's killed and he wants to get his body. And the state won't listen to him. And so he was going to kill Poroshenko, who was the former president and the biggest rival to Zelensky. But he couldn't find Poroshenko, and he knew where Parubi lived. And so he killed Parubi so that he would be sentenced to life, so that then he would be traded to Russia in a prisoner exchange and then have the Russians help him find his kid's body so that he could bury his son. That's a very weird story.
That's a pretty convoluted plan there.
I know. It's a very weird story.
But, you know, what really strikes me about it is the strange improbability of people hunting down and killing the commanders who got their sons killed. You know, Jeff Davis died peacefully. Robert E. Lee died peacefully. I mean, there were hundreds of thousands of American households who lost many of their children. And somehow, and I'll never understand this, nobody thought of just taking a little trip down to Virginia and shooting them in the head.
I know. And honestly, like, if you wanted to get traded, well, I guess his excuse is Parubi was there, but if you were that pissed off and that intent, I mean, well, first of all, why would you then flee the scene? He was captured in Khmelnytsky, which is very far away. If you do a political assassination or you intend to be caught and exchanged, you would shoot him, take off your helmet, lie down on the ground, you know, so that they won't shoot you, you know, hold your hands out. You wouldn't flee and hide. So a lot of it doesn't add up. A lot of Ukrainians don't believe it. Some think that he was somehow manipulated to do it. Like the state theory is that the Russians somehow blackmailed him or paid him or something to do it, but it doesn't quite add up. But, you know, it's possible he somehow, for whatever reason, agreed to be the patsy for this, or, you know, who knows?
Or Parubi was already a nuisance and, there's so much popular anger over all the young Ukrainians who've been killed that, you know, you use him as a safety valve. When he's murdered, people will say, yeah, we gotcha.
I mean, they have been talking about that as well in Ukraine. There were a lot of people celebrating it kind of blaming Ukraine for it. He's not particularly beloved because there's probably no single figure, if you trace the 30 years of the war, there's no single figure in Ukraine who has more deliberately pushed for this as a national project, a civilizational war with the Moskali, with the Russians, in order to liberate and purify Ukraine. Nobody's done it more intently than Andriy Parubi. And thanks to Western backing, he reached the heights of power. I mean, fucking the Speaker of Parliament. And so, yeah, if you hate the war, but that's not even necessarily what this guy was saying. You know, so who knows? But I agree that in terms of what he represents, which is a lot of dead sons, he makes more sense in that sense as a object of anger. Yeah.
It's one of those stories that will probably come out long after I'm dead. So, you know, send me a notice. read the stories over my grave.
Yeah, we'll bring the Ouija board and spell it out for you, I think so. Although I'll probably be long gone as well. And then I guess the last hit, and then we can wrap it up. You probably saw this, although I think you were traveling. The Americans took out a boat that they claim was a Venezuelan boat that they claim was a drug running boat. And boy, were they gloating over it. Boy, did they love it. They love the fact that there's really no legal basis for it. They're just gloating over it.
It did a strange thing to me. It reminded me, even though I've pretty much renounced George Orwell, it reminded me of a scene early in 1984 that always really horrified me when I read it in high school. It's when the people are all gathered in a movie theater for, I guess, the 2 minutes hate, and they show a helicopter dropping a bomb on a boat full of refugees, and everyone erupts in a big cheer.
Yeah, I mean, again, you know, this all takes place in a atmosphere where we have been watching live streamed and endless murders and assassinations. I mean, now it's almost 250 Palestinian journalists that you get to know personally through social media assassinated, healthcare figures, political figures, all kinds of people just murdered on top of all the other Palestinians daily. The Israelis have been mass assassinating in front of our eyes. I mean, they were doing it plenty before October 7th, but, you know, it's in turbo level since October 7th. And we who oppose it are completely powerless powerless to do anything about it, because the entire political establishment, the entire ruling classes are completely with Israel on it. 100% in Europe, here, you know, in all the rich countries.
That's been a bit of a surprise for me. Yeah. I wouldn't have thought there was that kind of unanimity.
Yeah. And I don't know. It's just, this is the atmosphere that these assassinations are taking place in. And I think, as we said the last time, it was the last summer after the attempted assassination of Trump, we just think we're going to be seeing more of this, because it's happening. And it's getting in people's heads, and they're seeing the reactions and what it does.
Yeah, and the video was nice and vague, as many people pointed out. Like, you can put in your imagination whoever you want, whoever you most hate, in that boat.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, you're talking about Venezuela. I'm sorry. I was bringing it back to Charlie Kirk. But yeah, no, you're absolutely right about that. Yeah. Yeah, they're now saying that the boat was trying to turn around, and that it turned out there wasn't even like a low-level drug running. That gang doesn't even exist anymore. I think Max Blumenthal pointed out that gang existed 30 years ago, and it was actually run by the CIA, and it caused a big fight with the DEA, that particular gang. And it was infiltrated by the CIA in order to try to get to Pablo Escobar back when he was a big deal. But yeah, they've been showing that. As you said, it's a vague video, the bombing of that boat. And as you said, you can put anyone in there that you want to. But in terms of more assassinations of people going forward, I think we're going to be seeing more of it for a while until it runs its course.
There should. Well, you know, the lull always seemed a little odd to me. I mean, there was a lull, like, for assassinations. Not for murders. There were always plenty of murders.
Yes.
But not political assassinations. And it doesn't seem so strange to me that it's resumed. What seemed strange was the lull.
Completely agree. I mean, a country completely awash in guns with a completely warped political system, everybody hating each other. Like, it is strange that there hasn't been more of it. And I think there's a sense, when you watch crime shows, anything about murder, they're always immediately solved. Everybody catches everything. And the weird thing that you're finding out with this is you can get away with a lot. Like Luigi, if he didn't, maybe he just didn't seem to plan for more than just getting out of the scene of the crime. Like he just, then after that is like, what do I do now? And he just kind of lurked around until for days or weeks until somebody at McDonald's, it was almost like he was at some point, like almost subconsciously trying to get caught. He might've been for all we know.
He might've been, he might've wanted to be a martyr. Still, I mean, if you can do the sniper rifle method, better to be, you know, a live survivalist than a dead martyr.
Yeah. All right. On that happy note, I think we can end this episode. Thanks again, everyone. Thanks, Brandon, John, and everyone
thanks, who everybody.
Supports the show. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.